The KYMN Climate Show is a monthly feature here on 95.1 The One and AM 1080, discussing changes in climate and the science behind it. And now, your hosts, Alan Anderson and Bruce Moreland.
Welcome to the KYMN Climate Show with Bruce Moreland and Al Anderson, where we discuss climate issues in the news and then dig into the stories behind those stories. For an overview today, we'll be talking about a couple of stories, and then we'll talk about Project Drawdown, doing what helps and doing what's necessary in the climate challenge. So, Bruce, what stories have we found?
Well, Al, we're going to talk today about how The Guardian, a well-known European and British magazine or newspaper, has changed its style guide. And we'll use that to talk a little bit about communication. And then we're going to talk about record heat in Baghdad and Death Valley, which are, you know, it's always interesting to hear how things are going there. And then we're going to talk about confirmation bias, and in particular that the Amazon is not the lungs of the world. And then you're going to talk about paleoclimatology. And remember, you're going to keep that at the right level, right?
And then later we'll be talking about Project Drawdown. So, Bruce, what's your first story?
Oh, this is so much fun. The Guardian has just changed its language. And I just want to back this up with a little personal story on language. I'm often attempt to shock my audiences a little bit by using the term anthropogenic global warming. You know, I mean, the activists have been playing with other terms. They went from global warming to climate change to climate crisis and climate apocalypse. You know, they just wandered off because they were afraid that global warming was too in your face or something, I guess. But I have a reason for why I use AGW, I don't pronounce it. I like to use the acronym.
Anthropomorphic.
Anthropogenic. Anyway, global warming is, I can easily explain that mathematically. I can go to the whiteboard and explain it to a room full of eighth graders, because I've done that. Big room, 400 of them. Whereas explaining how statistics and frequencies of event and Bayesian change point analysis and things like that can be used to confirm the predictions, that's a little bit harder. That would take more like a graduate course. So I use AGW because it's a term that people can immediately get, you know, they get excited when they hear it, because either they already know that I'm full of beans or they already know that I'm right. So I don't really have to explain it too much, but it's just useful for me. So The Guardian is changing the language it uses, and they're updating its style guide to introduce new terms that more accurately describe the environmental crisis facing the world. Instead of climate change, the preferred terms now are climate emergency, climate crisis, climate breakdown, and I got a kick out of this one, global heating, which you know, is essentially global warming, but by a less friendly phrase. The editor-in-chief said that they wanted to ensure they were scientifically precise while also communicating clearly with the readers on this very important issue. So the phrase climate change sounds rather passive and gentle, you know, and global warming, you know.
In Minnesota, sounds good.
Yeah, especially in January, February, you know, we're thinking, oh, this is warming. Oh, yeah, I think I'll have a warm cup of coffee. Some other terms that they've updated included they're going to use wildlife rather than biodiversity, and fish populations instead of fish stocks, and climate science denier rather than climate skeptic, which I've seen that before. And being in the conservative caucus, we kind of prefer neither of those phrases because they're both in your face and aggressive. And so we talk about real issues. We try and stay away from language. So we've talked, or I talk all the time about the media bias in my sources. And so I've said, well, how is the Guardian, what's its bias? And the answer is, it's believed by one media biasing site that they have a left-leaning bias. They lean left, but not too much. So it's a lean left as opposed to hard left. And part of it's because the Guardian's feature editor said so. That it's no secret that they are a center-left newspaper, center-left being the key. And it was founded in 1821. This may be more information than you thought I wanted to give, but they were to promote Enlightenment liberal interests, which is also known to those of us that practice this stuff as free markets and free people. And that's why a European liberal is an American conservative, but that's all right. Okay, so that, I just thought that was an interesting story because it gives me a chance to talk about how language can color, because we go on alert from language. Language sets us on alert way faster than facts and figures do. So, all right, so what's going on in Baghdad?
Well, one would hope that some facts and figures would get us pretty excited. You know, Baghdad has always been a pretty hot place, but even in Baghdad and other places in the Middle East, they're breaking their high temperature records. Last week, Baghdad reached 125 degrees Fahrenheit, the highest figure ever measured in the capital. Basra, which is their southern oil hub, hit a little bit higher than that, and just one degree short of that city's all-time record. And the stifling heat is forcing a lot of people to stay indoors. But of course, the challenge there is a lot of problem. People don't have reliable electricity. So if it's 125 out and you don't have air conditioning, being outside but in the shade looking for a breeze is probably the best you can do. Very challenging. And here's one of the things that I thought was pretty sobering about this article. And that is that, like most countries, Baghdad has the senior meteorologist for the Iraqi Meteorological Organization. So they have a top meteorologist. And he said, he's calling on the government to invest a lot more in renewable energy and decreasing their reliance on fossil fuels, which, of course, there's a lot of in Iraq, because he said, and this is their top government meteorological official, without such actions, in 10 years' time, we will not be able to live in Iraq. It'll be too hot.
So this high-level Iraqi official in a country that is dependent on petrodollars is arguing against their primary export. And do you think he's well-received doing that?
You know, you'd have to say, undoubtedly, he's not well-received. Undoubtedly, he knows he would not be well-received. But on the other hand, if his assessment of the weather is correct, it won't matter that they have lots of oil if nobody can live and work there.
Exactly. And it's just, you always have to try and follow the money to see where the roadblocks are.
Right.
And as much as I appreciate their turning to renewables, there's another, maybe 7 billion people that have to also learn how to use renewables. And that's a long, hard lesson. It's going to take some time.
And we'll be talking more about that when we're talking about drawdown.
Indeed.
Then a similar story is that according to Death Valley National Park, they have recorded their highest temperature ever, 130 degrees, and that may be one of the highest temperatures ever recorded on the planet with reliable records. Going way back in time, there are times in the 1800s and the early 1900s when, with less reliable gear, there were temperatures that were somewhat higher. 134 degrees was recorded in Death Valley, for example, in much earlier. But that's in question because of the equipment that was being used. But I think one of the really important things to remember is we can quibble about whether 130 or 134 or 137 are the highest temperatures. The only thing we really need to remember is if it's 105 degrees, you can't be outside.
Right. The human body can't endure 105 even with shade. It's interesting. So what you're saying is the record books are going to have all kinds of asterisks on some of those old records because they were estimates.
Yep.
Kind of like I wonder how many asterisks are going to have to use this on the 2020 baseball season. to note that it wasn't a real season.
Yeah. And I think the important takeaway from all of these, though, is that more and more around the world in lots of different countries, especially along the equator, they're more frequently having temperatures that are really unlivable if you can't be indoors with some kind of air conditioning. And Phoenix has been setting new records with its number of days over 100, and they're breaking their records of the number of days over 110. When in a beautiful city in the United States of America, you can't be outside. And their workers are starting work at midnight and working through the night because they can't work outside during the day.
You know, your farm workers are experiencing the same thing. The people who allow us to eat good fresh vegetables and things all year long, because we can ship them and, you know, move them around the country, which, you know, that's a transportation cost. They're having to work odd hours because they can't work during the heat of the day, and it's just not going to get better.
Nope, unfortunately, it's not. So, Bruce, what's your other story?
Oh well, I just had to hit on this one. Everybody likes to talk about the rainforest in the Amazon being the lungs of the world and all of that. And this is an example of a confirmation bias story for me. And why do I say that? Well, since I understand that global warming is happening, I don't have any doubts about that. The probabilities are, you know, off the chart. When I hear stories that kind of confirm that bias, I don't really question them. But since I am a scientist and sort of do like to, you know, you notice that my earlier slight, you know, center left, The Guardian, is balanced by a center right publication called Forbes. And they finally brought a story to my attention, and I thought, oh, well, just like with The Guardian, I tracked it back, and I tracked this one back too, and it was really interesting. The increase in the fires in Brazil set off a storm of outrage, right? I'm sure that all kinds of people were making all kinds of social media statements about how we were destroying the world's largest rainforest, et cetera, which we are. But that's not the lungs of the world, but they like to say it is. And all these notable scientists, or maybe they're really more social media authorities, whatever that's worth. Madonna and Jaden Smith, there's a couple of credible sources for you, shared photos that were seen by tens of millions of people. So they got a huge reach. The lungs of the world of the earth are in flames, said actor Leonardo DiCaprio. With a name like Leonardo, he must be a scientist, right? I've heard that name before. Anyway, either that or he's a ninja turtle. I can't remember which. He said the Amazon rainforest produces more than 20% of the world's oxygen. And then, of course, here's a real expert, a soccer star, who tweeted that the rainforest, the lungs which produce 20% of the oxygen, is on fire. These are all interesting, but it turned out that when you looked behind the story, which we tend to do here at KYMN, in this case, Forbes looked behind the story for us, and they said, you know, the photo that they used, some of them were taken years ago. They weren't of the Amazon. In fact, Montana, India, and Sweden were some of the places where the photos came from. And to their credit, some news sources debunked the photos and other misinformation. Deforestation is not limited to one nation. And here's the problem with all of this, is because these activist types or social media authorities essentially lied. Alan and I had a big discussion about whether I could use the word lie. I'm going to use it. But anyway, because they were caught in a prevarication, is that right?
Misinformation.
Misinformation, yeah. The Times was able to say these fires are not caused by climate change, which is also wrong, but because these other people opened the door, the New York Times was able to, or the Times was able to say that they weren't caused by that. And in general, little lies lead to general mistrust of the media. And it just annoys me. And remember when I opened and I said it's easy to explain AGW, anthropogenic global warming, because that's a simpler model than explaining why increased fires in California are due to higher temperatures, which in turn has been drying out the material faster, so that blah, 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 blah. You can see I've even lost Alan, and he usually likes to follow me down these paths. So that's the point I'm trying to make, is that when you get into an echo chamber where you already believe what you're hearing, just like I didn't really question this stuff about the Amazon. I was kind of suspicious, you know. I knew where O2 was coming from. And in fact, as a footnote, I thought, where does the O2 come from that we breathe? Well, the answer is it's all paleogenic. I mean, back when the oxygen crisis happened, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that was when the planet changed from being a reducing to an oxidizing atmosphere, and all the tetanus-type bugs had to go underground. I don't know if you knew that, Alan. Yeah.
And is this like 2 billion years ago?
440 billion, something like that. Yeah, it's a million, 440 million. It's a while back, but it's, you know, in any case. When you look for where the oxygen comes from that we have, it's all from old, you know, old processes. And it's about 70 to 80% of oxygen being generated today comes from phytoplankton and macroalgae, also known as kelps. In the ocean. So it's the ocean that's producing the O2. And another source said 50 to 85%. And I love the fact that there's bands on all of this, because going back to what Alan was talking about, when you measure something, if you don't measure it precisely with, you know, where you've got some scientific tools being used, then you end up with, you know, oddball numbers like 50 to 85%. But, yeah.
So, Bruce, I think everybody knows that through the photosynthesis process,
right,
trees take in CO2 and give off oxygen. So can you explain a little bit about the cycle there and why it's more net neutral?
I can. Here's the reason. It turns out that when trees are first growing, they really do release more O2 and absorb more CO2 than the other way around. So they are net oxygen producers while the forest is growing. Once it's mature, it kind of levels off and doesn't consume, because they have to consume just like we do. They have to consume O2 part of the time to grow, to maintain themselves. So what's the name of that company that cuts down forests up in northern Minnesota?
And Weyerhaeuser.
Weyerhaeuser. A lot of people, just on general principles, because of their echo chamber, may not like Weyerhaeuser. But I got to tell you, they are doing something to sequester carbon, because they're planting new trees which absorb a lot of CO2, and then they're turning those trees into products that they aren't burning them, for the most part. They're using them to produce something that we need anyway. So it's a very useful and sustainable part of our carbon cycle.
Lumber and plywood that actually sequesters the carbon.
Exactly, sequesters. I'm going back to the plankton. I can't wait to buy a T-shirt that has a logo on it that says "Save the Plankton, Breathe Freely." I mean, there's a boy. Doesn't that just make you want to run around?
So, one of the challenges, and this is the super summary of that, is that the rainforest may produce 20% of the global production of oxygen. But the problem is that's only half the story, because then it uses it again.
Exactly. It uses as much as it produces. And in fact, when you look at the numbers, the whole land biomass, which means all your farmland and tree, you know, forests and everything else, are producing 20% or so. And it doesn't talk about how much they're consuming. So when you look at the O2 balance charts, you can see what's going on there. But that's another story. So I mentioned paleo something or another, oxygen.
Paleoclimatology.
Yeah, which is your story.
So climatologists who study ancient history are called paleoclimatologists. And there's quite a number of them around the world today. And one of the things that they have studied is the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere going into the distant past. And they've learned that for the last about 800,000 years, when we have had regular 100,000-year cycles of glaciation, that we rarely got above 280 parts per million. And then during ice ages, it would be lower than that. Well, they said, when was the last time we were at 417 parts per million in the atmosphere, which is where we are today? And in looking at the ancient records, they estimate that it's about 3 million years ago. And at that time, sea levels were about 60 feet higher, and temperatures were several degrees warmer. And an interesting note there is only several degrees warmer, but that was enough to melt the ice to put us at 60 feet higher. So if history repeats itself based on the carbon cycle and the greenhouse effect, they would guess that that's where we're going again, slowly. And if we don't do anything to impact that 417, we will slowly be headed in the direction of much warmer and 60 feet higher sea levels, which would, of course, submerge pretty much every major coastal city on the planet. So you'd have to say, obviously, we don't want to go there. And one of the challenges then is, what are current climate scientists saying about where we're headed now? We're at 417. Are we working hard to bring it down? And their reports say that if we just keep doing what we're doing, business as usual, we're probably going to end up around 800 parts per million, almost double where we are now, and that would be significantly warmer temperatures. If we get more serious about lowering emissions in kind of a mid-range, we would probably end up somewhere around 600 parts per million, or another 50% increase. And then their lowest estimate, if we really get aggressive, and this is even more aggressive than the current Paris Climate Accord commitments, the aggressive lowering of emissions might keep us from getting much higher. So we need something even more aggressive than that to bring 417 down if we don't want to head towards much higher sea levels. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about those issues when we talk later about Project Drawdown.
Well, that's kind of interesting, this paleoclimatology issue and the fact that we're looking back. One of the things you might wonder is how much lag time is there? Because we're already at 417 and we know the oceans should be 60 feet higher. Well, if you follow the science and you follow the news stories and the right sources, you can read that Greenland ice is disappearing and the Antarctic ice cap is shredding itself into the ocean. So this is all those secondary things that you can say are predicted by the models, and sure enough, they're going on.
Yep.
But the problem we have as humans is we have a real hard time. We're like the frogs in the boiling water.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see slow change. If that 60 feet showed up tomorrow on the coast, we'd notice it. But if it shows up every year as a little bit, it's not quite so noticeable. The good news is it does give us time to get out of the way. The bad news is we have all these programs like FEMA that will help ensure that we don't get out of the way fast enough. And I hate to throw in a little political thing there. But
just a quick sidebar. I just read an article yesterday that FEMA is developing a new major strategy for the most vulnerable and hardest to protect coastlines, and it's moving the population inland.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is something that, you know, an awful lot of people won't like that, but your choice is you can either move inland now at a controlled pace, or you can wait until your house is washed down by
right.
the next hurricane.
Until you have to move. You don't have any choices. So it's a tough, it's just our political selves just don't quite know how to handle this kind of stuff. And one famous person once said, what good does it do to understand what's happening if you don't do anything about it?
Right.
So, and we'll have more on that on our next show, in fact. So, our focus today is going to be drawdown. And Alan, what's drawdown?
So, there's an organization that has developed, and they initially called themselves Project Drawdown. And it's a large group of scientists who asked the simple question, what are the things that will have the greatest impact in moving us towards a sustainable climate? And they've run it in several different ways, but one of their question was, if we want to actually stay and not go past plus 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is what scientists are saying we desperately need to try to do, what would be required? And then they looked at all kinds of different ways to approach that. For example, more onshore wind turbines, more utility-scale solar, reducing food waste, composting, recycling, driving an electric car. And they researched the whole supply chain impact of these different methods. And then they rank ordered them on how many tons of CO2 would be reduced or sequestered if we did X plan. And then they put out a rank ordered list. And I've got that list in front of me as we're talking, and it's a list that we will try to put on our website for you to look at. But the number one biggest impact is building more onshore wind turbines. And the second biggest is building more utility-scale solar photovoltaic power plants, which an awful lot of companies are doing. And I might mention Xcel Energy. They have committed to reducing their electric generating capacity to be 80% renewable by 2030 and 100% renewable by 2050. And they're relying very heavily on those two items, wind turbines, utility scale solar, and then also storing it in what I would call a mega battery. Well, what can I as one person and a civilian do relative to helping with onshore wind turbines? And many power companies like Xcel have a program called WindSource. And so if you're an Xcel utility customer, you can sign up for WindSource. And what that simply means is that you agree to pay a little bit more per kilowatt that you use. And then Xcel Energy uses that money essentially to buy or to build more wind.
So you're basically using a market force to send a market signal to somebody that otherwise might just ignore you if you just went down and waved a sign at them.
Exactly.
I love market forces.
Yep. Interestingly, the third item on the list after wind and solar, and you might find this hard to believe, but it has to do with the entire supply chain, and that is reduce food waste. And you would say, well, wait a minute, how is that even possible? Well, it's estimated that around the world, fully one-third of all food that's produced is never eaten. It goes to waste. It's not even eaten by livestock. It might spoil in the field. It might not get the refrigeration it needs. And in wealthy countries, it might not look nice. It might have too many bumps on it. So we discard it instead of eating it, even though it might be perfectly good food. Now, you might be thinking just about, well, how is just throwing that food away a big energy thing? But if we eliminated wasting one-third of it, then we would reduce, for example, the energy that's inputs to agricultural production by one-third. So, and then it also creates a lot of methane if it's rotting somewhere. So that's something everybody can do. Reduce food waste and make a commitment that in your family, you're not going to throw anything that you buy away.
So I've often heard people say, you're just going to have to give up eating hamburgers and stuff. I mean, you just can't do that anymore. But where is that on your list of things? And where is something like, oh, I'm going to compost and feel good about myself? Where is that on the list?
So those are good questions, Bruce. And interestingly, changing your diet away from meat and towards a plant-rich diet, and this does not necessarily mean vegan or vegetarian, but just way less meat. If you change to a plant-rich diet, that is number four on the list. That's right ahead of putting panels on your house or driving an electric car.
Yeah, you know, I changed to a lower meat diet, but I never gave up eating venison.
Indeed. And then your other question about, so where is composting? You know, composting is easy. It's convenient. It makes a lot of sense, but doesn't have that much of an impact. It's number 62 on the list after an awful lot of other things like insulating your house, changing to LED lighting, getting a hybrid or an electric car. Electric cars are number 27.
Yeah, but Alan, think about this, though. What's the biggest problem with a lot of these personal effort actions is that it does two things. One, it does help a little tiny bit. But the other thing it does is it lets you pat yourself on the back and say, I've done my part and I don't have to do anything more.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we know that the market is distorted by a lot of forces, including tragedies of the commons. So how do we solve that problem and really make a meaningful impact on what's going on?
Bruce, that is just a wonderful segue. As you might know, we're both members of Citizens Climate Lobby also. And we're also members of our local Rotary Club Climate Action Team. But one of the things that we are working on in Citizens Climate Lobby is something called a carbon fee and dividend. And carbon fee and dividend is when you basically put a fee or a tax on fossil fuels as they come into a port or out of the ground, and then you return all of that money to households. That's the dividend portion of it. And one would say, well, what difference does any of that make? Well, it'll increase the price of everything that's fossil fuel related. That means the cost of heating and cooling and transportation and food will probably all rise.
It's a very small rise, though.
It's a small rise. But then the dividend makes households either come out even or even slightly ahead for most families. The lower 70% of household incomes come out even or ahead. And then, by comparison, market forces drive pretty much everyone towards things that are less carbon intensive. So eventually, the electric car is going to be cheaper in the long run than an internal combustion engine. So even if people didn't care about climate change, they would still buy an electric car because it makes more economic sense. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of a carbon fee and dividend. And right now, as we speak before Congress, H.R. 763 is pretty much exactly this bill. It's got over 80 sponsors, co-sponsors now, including a few Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there's just recently a companion bill in the Senate. So this is not a distant pipe dream. This is something that's actually getting ever closer to being within our reach. And probably more than anything else on this list of individual items, this one thing would impact all of the solutions that are on this list by driving companies, entrepreneurs, and individuals towards using less carbon in their lives.
And it's done in a market-friendly, freedom-friendly way, a way that appeals to me as a free market guy. Let me review what we've talked about today. We talked a little bit about language, and in particular how The Guardian changed its style guide. And in the process, we talked a little bit about how you qualify and find out why they might have done that. We talked about some record heat waves in the world, and we talked about confirmation bias, and in particular that the Amazon is not the lungs of the planet, even though even I fell into that because it confirmed what I already believed, which was wrong. And so it was kind of an interesting, I thought that was a very self-revealing moment on the radio. And then we talked about paleoclimatology a little bit and how things used to be and how they could be. And Alan didn't mention tipping points, but we're going to have to talk about those someday because that's, I'll have to have a whiteboard.
Indeed.
Though. That's a really interesting one. So anyhow, that's what we talked about today.
So for links to today's stories in the science, please see the KYMM website and look under programs for The Climate Show. And also feel free to send us any questions if you've got them. You can send them to climateshow@kymnradio.net.
Don't forget to visit our website. I'm going to be putting a lot of stuff out there for you. Next month, on Wednesday, October 7th at 11 a.m., we'll be discussing the politics of climate solutions. Hey, Alan, did you know, I bet you not many people are aware of the fact there's an election coming up.
Is there?
So we'll be very timely, and we're going to talk about the activists for solutions in the GOP and the activists for solutions in the DFL and how those two sets of activists differ and how they're received by their own parties. a little bit of tribal investigation here. And then we'll talk a little bit about Braver Angels and With Malice Toward None, very important program. And
we'll we might even slip in there, whatever party you're in, be sure you go and vote.
Yes, we will probably end with a go and vote.
So, God willing and the crick don't rise, we'll be back next month with another edition of The Climate Show. Thanks
for listening.
You've been listening to the KYMN Climate Show, airing the first Wednesday of every month here on 95.1 FM and AM 1080. Your hosts have been Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. Copies of today's show are available for podcast at kymnradio.net.